and particularly in recent months the tremendous success she had with the passing of the Child Protection Bill in Great Britain. From go to woe, 9 months, and the bill was passed on the British law, passed by Parliament and signed by the Queen. And we're very pleased, of course, all of us, to have Mary Whitehouse here tonight to address us and to challenge us, inspire us on this theme of child care, not child abuse.
Gentlemen, I was travelling back from London one night, just two people in the compartment, another lady in the far corner and me in this corner, and I was reading my papers, but every time I glanced up she was peering at me with a sort of puzzled expression on her face, and then she'd look away when I looked up, and there she was all the way like this. Anyway, just before I got to my stop to get up, she suddenly said to me, she looked up at me, she said, "Oh," she said, "all the way," she said, "I've been wondering who you reminded me of." She said, "Now I know." She said, "Mrs. Mary Whitehouse." But she said, "Don't bother, dear, you're much better looking." I rather treasure that, actually. I'm not, in fact, when I'm at home, as I think all the media and everybody else would tell you, I have never, ever made it my policy in any way to spend time contradicting smears which have been made to us. We get on with a job that we believe has to be done, and we leave time to tell its own story. But as I am visiting in your country, and as this time today, a fortnight, I shall be back home, I do think there's one thing that's been said while I've been here, that you won't really be in any position at all to know whether this is true or not. I would just briefly like to deal with it, and that's because, you see, after I've gone, this can be used not as a smear against me, but as a smear against the people who will be working, and that is that I am anti-black. Now, I should just tell you that when I went back into teaching, when our eldest child went to university, I was living in Wolverhampton, and those of you who know anything about the West Midlands will know that Wolverhampton was one of the places where so many of the Indians and Pakistanis and West Indians came to live. And the classes that I taught, some of the classes, were as much as 3 parts coloured and 1 part white. So no way is there any foundation whatsoever for any statement of that kind. And I had to come to Australia to have that said to me for the first time in the whole of my life. And I think that's a classic example of the way people who, for whatever motive, are trying to smear and so on, will do so without any foundation of any kind at all. And I would suggest, too, that you take the various other smears with the same amount of pinch of salt and come to your own conclusions. Now, I would like to deal with another issue which is suggested from time to time, was even suggested today over the media in covering this meeting and the protest group outside, that some way I have some power to do things, to get things done. Now, in order that you again may be in a position to judge for yourself, may I take just a few minutes to tell you how it comes about that here I'm on this platform here with you. Why aren't I back home cooking my husband's supper? I should tell you he's in Italy with our eldest son, his family, and having a very good time, in case any of you are worried about him. But how does it come about? And did I really, as has been suggested from time to time, sit down one day, complete with blue rinse and butterfly specs and all the rest of it, twiddling my thumbs, wondering what to do with my spare time, and say, good idea, I'll clean up television? No, of course not. In 1963, which to some of you is a long time ago, to others of you not so long ago, but a year that I want to say a few things about. In 1963, I was, of course, a wife and a mother. We had some of our children still at home then. I had a home to run, and I was what we call back in Britain senior mistress. That's the senior woman on the staff of a large mixed school. And in that capacity, responsible, quote, for the moral welfare of the children. And one of the group of senior staff involved in the pioneering work in the field of sex education. About that is another story. But that was what was happening at that time. That was where I found myself. more than totally occupied, as I imagine most ladies here would accept. But now that in 1963, and I think in a way it's worth saying this, because my own belief, for what it's worth, is that when the history of the second half of the 20th century, certainly as far as not just Britain, but the whole of the Western world is concerned, comes to be written, I think that 1963 will be seen to be a very traumatic year indeed. Now, I know, because of the response I've already had, that you here will remember, for instance, the Profumo scandal that brought down a government. You will remember, because you had it here, Bishop John Robinson's Honest to God, with the great newspaper headlines that followed, "God is dead," says Bishop. Not he exactly said that, but there you are. "God is dead," said Bishop. "Man has come of age, no longer needs God," said other papers. The same time, we had, back in Britain, and I know you've had them here since, three nights a week, we had David Frost's late night satire show, which I think satire is a very useful weapon. I'm not at all convinced it's a mass media weapon. But there we have, three nights a week, we had these shows which attacked everything which was of value and which gave stability to our society. We also had something called the Wednesday Play, but I won't bother you with that. These were the kitchen sink things we used to have every Wednesday night, which brought a row in the national press every Thursday morning. Now, here was I at school, and I think it's worth realizing this, that the year before, in 1962, we had produced the most prestigious report on the future of education in Britain. It was a government report, 1962, the year before all those things. And what did it say? Talking about sex education, it said this: "Sex instruction must be given on a basis of chastity before marriage and fidelity within it." That's just in 1962. Now, whether I had been a Christian or I hadn't been a Christian, that was a responsibility laid upon me as a teacher. And what I found, without going into a lot of details at all, was that the ideas which were pouring out over the media, the publicity given to the whole of the honest-to-God situational ethics, the new morality, the publicity was such that the children for whom I was responsible were totally confused. And I tell you this, you talk about the power of the media, but in one 40-minute program, the children for whom I was responsible and with whom, over months, we had a most creative and constructive dialogue in the whole field of human relationships, had saw that program one night, and when they came to school the next morning, waiting for me at the school gate, and what they had seen in that one program had moved them in 40 minutes. It had destroyed 2,000 years of the tenets of the Christian faith in relation to human sexuality. And it became abundantly clear to me that no way could I fulfill my obligations to the children for whom I was responsible unless something was done about television. That's how it began, ladies and gentlemen. There were just four of us when we started. But that's what we began with. And what I want to say to you is this, that no way do we have any power as such. If it were handed to me on a gold plate, I'd say, take it away. That is, we have no power to ban programs. We have no power to stop things being published. We have no power at all except what everybody else has in a democracy, and that is the power of public opinion. And I tell you this, that if there hadn't been a vast amount of public opinion behind us, I wouldn't be standing here in front of you tonight. I've got a family, I've got a home, I've got a garden, I've got grandchildren. Why should I be here? I wasn't a frustrated feminist or anything else. I was a woman with a career and a family and a home and a job. And I was completely satisfied on that level. But in my heart, I knew. And I could see what was happening to the children. And they were totally vulnerable in this situation. And not least were they totally vulnerable, because the people who should have been standing up, not in having repressive attitudes, but at least putting some kind of standards and values, at least for the children to try and knock down. But if there's nothing there, what do the kids do? I always remember when one of my children, who was a very, the neighbours had some things to say about him, a very, very lively child indeed. And I remember one day he was doing something, I can't now remember. And I was doing something else, and I said, "Oh, stop that," or whatever. And he went on. And then I stopped. stopped what I was doing, and I turned round and I said to him, I said, look, you will stop that. And he looked up to me in his face and he said, do you mean it, Mummy? And I said, yes, I do. Oh, good, he said. And he stopped doing it. And you see, what he was doing was saying to me, I want something from you. And children need for their own security, not for their repression. They actually need for their freedom. They need the kind of guidelines and pillars of belief within our society that give them actually the basis on which they, in their turn, can question and rebel. But if we don't put those things into our society, the kids get so involved with trying to cope with all the turmoil inside themselves. They get so afraid of what apparently it is, the kind of adult life we offer them, that they recoil from being adults. And of course you see the hard, cold fact, ladies and gentlemen, is that but it was created by the middle-aged entrepreneur who wanted to line his pocket, by the trendy cleric who wanted to get his name into the newspaper, by the far-left intellectual who thought that in all this there was profit to be gained. And now, in case I forget to tell you later, I may come back to it, what I have to tell you is that certainly back in Britain, the young are waking up and waking up fast. Why? Because for a couple of decades, they have been told that to have sex when you want it is freedom. To do what you want when you want to is freedom. To take drugs, to be free to take drugs, is freedom. To have pornography freely available is freedom. And it's a very seductive philosophy. But you see, they now look. And I speak here for what's happening in Britain. 20 years on, what have we got? We have got a rise in violent crime every year of 12.5%. We have rocketing figures for venereal disease, rocketing figures for cervical cancer, rocketing figures for broken homes, rocketing figures for children at risk and single-parent families, rocketing figures for mental ill health. Can any of those things be equated with freedom? No, they can't. Now I want to say something else to you, if I may. What has happened, and if you allow me, that over the 15 years of campaigning, we have built up colleagues and contacts across the states, in Europe, and of course here in Australia. So we are in a position to have some kind of assessment on a pretty worldwide basis. And to simplify it all, this is what it amounts to. That you have those who are determined, for whatever reason, to keep pushing back what Sir Hugh Green, formerly Director General of the BBC, described as the bounds of acceptability. He was very keen on that, actually. Very keen indeed. The bounds of acceptability. And it's a very simple process. You do something on television, you publish something in a magazine, you get another outlandish idea spoken out in the newspapers, and what shocks on first receipt shocks less on second receipt, and less still on third. So that by the time one becomes less concerned about these things, so another break is made. So things go further, and go further, and go further. So you have on the one side the people as a whole who are so confused because they lack leadership, who are constantly told through the media, well, it's just you, dear, you're out of touch. You're fuddy-duddy. You're all these things. So people are conditioned to keep their mouths shut because they're afraid of opening them. Now that's one thing that happened. And the other thing is, as I say, these vested interests. And make no mistake about it whatever, that the whole of the pornography scene is a multi-million pound industry. And I want to tell you this. I want to tell you this. The same week that we got our Protection of the Child Bill onto the statute book in Britain, the President of the United States signed an even stronger bill in the United States. Now, I may misjudge the child pornographers, but they're going to be like, I believe, like all commercial people are. They've got a product to sell. And if one market shuts and another market shuts, they're going to look for a fresh market. So all I'm suggesting to you is that you may find you're under more, not less, pressure. So a bit at a time, we've become accustomed to accepting language, behavior, and so on, that we would never previously have accepted. And then, all of a sudden, last year, with the help of the press and television, the British people were made aware of the fact that now children were to be used in this pornography industry. I remember one paper ringing me up, and he said, Mrs. Whitehouse, you must be shocked. I said, well, if you mean surprised, the answer must be no. So he said, why? I said, why should anybody be surprised? We've come to terms with the exploitation of women. We've gone to the stage where teenage models are dressed up as little children for the titillation of men who like the little ones. I said, why should anybody be surprised that in looking for a new gimmick, they used the actual children? It was simply the next step, but next step or no, I tell you that when that realization burst on the people of Britain, they said with a united voice, thus far and no further. Thus far and no further. And we initiated a nationwide campaign, nationwide in the sense that it went all over the country. We have neither the facilities or anything else to make it totally nationwide. But in 3 months, we got 1.6 million signatures. And on every signature, we asked for the number of refusals. And the number of percentage of people that signed that petition, 99.96. That's all right. Can we go on with the meeting, ladies and gentlemen? Let's just take no notice at all. My dress will wash, and I'm quite happy. 99 points, yes, come on. You don't take any notice. I mean, when you come to look at it, it's actually... I've lost this, haven't I? Is this on? Ah, I say, when you come to look at it, it actually goes rather nicely with my blouse. Now, I was just talking about the children, so let's go back to the children, shall we? Ladies and gentlemen, shall we just talk together, you and I? And we go back to the children. And 99.96 of the people of Great Britain who had the chance to sign that petition did so. And as a result of that, the government at home, who at first was not willing to do anything about child pornography, believing one, that we didn't have a problem, and two, that the law was already adequate, had to look seriously at it. They agreed in the end the law was not adequate, and they moved. And it was with the total support of the House of Commons of both parties, the House of Lords of both parties, that bill was passed. Now, it was immensely significant. As here you had a country that had come to terms with so much, who said, touch our children, just touch our children, and see what happens. But I have to tell you this, ladies and gentlemen, I really made a vow before I came to Australia that no way would I criticise Australia. But in a way, what we're talking about is an international problem. Australia can't isolate itself, and we can't isolate Australia. It's all the same problem. Now, when we passed that bill, do you know that when we did that, we had not had on public display in Britain, freely available or even seen on the bookstalls, what might generally be called pictures of boys and girls. These are nude pictures of boys which are used, as you will know and as I will know, by certain, perhaps rather inadequate males who find it difficult to make a relationship with a female. Now, the bill that we had in Britain didn't even mention the word pornography. It had to do with indecency, and it dealt with and makes illegal the distribution, the publication, the filming, distribution by film or magazine or anything else, of indecent photographs of any child or anyone who appears to be under the age of 16. Now, the books which made us move were sold under the counter in Soho only. When I came to South Australia, I saw them freely available with the ticket, unrestricted sale on them. You've got a problem, ladies and gentlemen. You may not have it here. I'm sure you haven't got it here. Well, I think I'm sure you haven't got it here. You'll have to make up your minds about that. But you have it in Australia. And you have no customs control between one state and another. And if you know ways in which determined people with lorries and cars and the rest are going to be stopped taking that stuff from state to state. You'd better tell your whoever's responsible, because I don't know how it can be done. You may know. But there you've got your Achilles heel. You have your Achilles heel. And unless somehow unitedly you can find ways of dealing with it, then you have indeed got a problem. And I think, too, that one has to realize that I saw in the paper this morning the great concern about the amount of the physical abuse of a child, particularly within the home, and particularly of the father with the daughter and the child. And it went on to say, it talked about the tensions and the pressures under which people live today, and that this is one of the reasons why it's happening. Well, of course we live under tensions and pressures, but ladies and gentlemen, we have always lived under tensions and pressures. I mean, if one thinks of the years of the last war, who lived under more tension and pressure than then? But then, you see, we had something. We had foundations. And what we have seen over these years has been a calculated attack upon the Christian faith, upon the family, upon society, upon all those, whether they're police or government or whatever, in whose hand the stability of the state remains. Now when you get those kind of pressures and you destroy the things that give stability, then of course the child is going to be the one that is most at risk. And this is the situation, the whole question of incest within the family. This is really what it's all about. And if you have, on television, through advertisements or whatever, the philosophy that what I want, I should be able to have because I want it, and not only have, but have now. I mean, if you put it terribly crudely, if you get programs on television, which we most certainly have, which are titillating in the extreme, and the wife is either too tired or unwilling to be prepared to respond, maybe the father will look to his daughter. But don't let any of us kid ourselves that when titillating material comes out like that, if it's repressed, it's almost as bad. So there's that kind of social responsibility, those kind of pressures, and all the time the children at risk. Now I said right at the beginning that we have no power, but we are where we are today, and I am here where I am tonight, because the great mass of the people have been behind what we've been doing. And we've gone on and on saying in and out of season certain things which to us were simple common sense. Let me tell you one. We said this. If you constantly portray violence as normal on the television screen, you will help, the degree of help is arguable, you will help to create a violent society. You would surely now find it difficult to realise the amount of abuse and ridicule that came our way for saying that. You have no idea some of the things I was called, even on television, for making a statement of that kind. But you see, as the years have gone on, everybody is now accepting this. And just before I came away, the British government have produced a white paper on the future of broadcasting. And what did they say? Well, I don't take it as any matter of pride, I just take it a matter of relief. That in their paper, the British government said this: up to now, broadcasting authorities have worked on the basis that if there is no proof that television violence does harm, then it's all right to have it. The government has now said this, and said it quite unequivocally, that the broadcasting authorities must now work on the assumption that television violence is damaging to society unless there is proof that it is not. Now that is a complete reversal of the whole of the previous philosophy in relation to television violence. But it happens to be precisely what we've been saying all these years. And there's really only one other aspect of this abuse of the child that I do want to speak about, because I know it is to some extent relevant to some of your public debate here. Now, it's 12 years now since it was made legal in Britain for consenting adults to have homosexual practices. Now, at that time, I was not in any way involved, really, with the argument, except in my own private capacity around that. And I certainly don't want to get engaged in the debate here. But I do think that I can at least share with you, with hindsight, what we now see. There were very many enlightened and compassionate people who felt that that would be an enlightened and compassionate law. What we now see as happening is that that law, certainly for the militant homosexuals, has become the basis upon which they demand an ever greater lowering of the age of consent. 18, 21 now, down to 18, there are those who will demand it down to what they call the child's teenage, early teenage years. There are even those groups that work in British society who are demanding the repeal, the removal of the age of consent for both homosexual and heterosexual experiences. And you talk, we talk about a sick society. And you can argue about the rights of one individual adult to see this and the rights of one adult to see that. But when you get to the place where the tender, vulnerable bodies of little children are to be made available, they can choose, they say, for both homosexual and heterosexual practice, then indeed we are a sick, a very sick society. So we're now experiencing this at home. And the other thing that we've seen is the fact that they demand the right to go into schools, and they proselytize. And what you discover here is that if you allow them into the schools, then you put adolescent boys and girls who are going through what is always a stormy and often difficult period, what indeed the psychiatrists call the adolescent phase, when the boy of 13 has a pash on the cricket captain or whatever and wants to clean his boots, when the little girl of the same age brings a bunch of flowers for the head of the school. That is a perfectly normal phase to go through. If you allow people to come into school and say to children of that age that you have now arrived at the ultimate in human sexual relationships, it is an act of dogmatism and repression. You hold those children by the pressure of your propagandizing and proselytizing. You hold them down into immaturity. Now, if that is not a denial of freedom, ladies and gentlemen, I do not know what is. I do not know what is. And I would just say to you, maybe you have none of these problems. Maybe what I'm talking to you now is another world. It may not be another world for you in 2 or 3 years' time. But what I tell you is what has happened not only in Britain, far worse on the continent, and far worse in America. So, in a small world, why, oh why, should this great continent and the people living here who have so much to give think that any way your children or your families are going to be less pressurized than the rest of us? Only one other area I would just suggest, if you're a concerned parent, maybe again absolutely no problem, but certainly back at home in the field of sex education, in which, as I told you, I was involved, there has been very great anxiety back home about the activities of the Family Planning Association in schools. They are now moving into the schools and taking over the whole business of the fact, if I can recover something from the mess here, it hasn't gone on the letter words, so that's the thing. I don't know whether she's true of you, but I know that the FPA is an international organisation, and I haven't seen any sign anywhere that it says we'll do this in all the other countries except Australia. Haven't seen that at all. So what kind of material? A booklet called Learning to Live with Sex for the 13 to 16 year olds talks always about sexual intercourse in terms of boys and girls. Not even men and women, let alone man and wife. The only responsibility suggested is the use of contraceptives. And they list various sympathetic, as they call them, birth control, abortion and homosexual organisations where children can go, quote, which will not tell your parents unless you want them to, and so on. Now, time flies. I would only suggest that as parents, you might wish to know, and you may be very well satisfied with what you find. So I don't want to be here suggesting things that don't exist. But perhaps some of the things I've said will help you to understand. And in a way, if I may just say so in passing, perhaps what's happened here tonight will help you to understand too. I don't see any reason why you should live in any kind of cloud cuckoo land. And I imagine that you're not. Can I just finish by referring to what I said earlier on? No, I won't. I'll do what I promised myself I will every time. About 3 years ago now, we had what I would say was arguably the greatest television programme which has ever been produced. This was an interview with Alexander Solzhenitsyn. A remarkable affair from beginning to end. All the press, all the media were told that he was being brought from his hideout, I think one has to call that in Zurich, to Broadcasting House in London to do this interview. Well, to Television Centre in London. He would then be taken back, and they were asked not to say a word till he was safely back in Zurich. And sometimes when one hears talk about the irresponsibility of the press and the rest, I have to tell you that not one newspaper or media person in the whole of Britain leaked the tiniest leak. Came, did his interview, he went back. And then we knew. And during the course of that interview, he said this. And you know, as I sat and listened, if you got Solzhenitsyn inside your own living room, just a few yards away from you, by Jove, it's an intensely personal experience. And after I'd heard him speak, and I knew he was already back there, I made a vow. I thought, you will probably not be able to say it again anywhere. But I will say it every time I get a chance. I will say, and I pick out two of the things he said that night. He was being told by the interviewer about him, you know, are you not a great critic of the West? And his reply was this, I am not a critic of the West, and you're part of the West too, aren't you? I repeat that for nearly all our lives we worshipped it. Note the word worshipped, he said. I am not a critic of the West. I am a critic of the weakness of the West. I am a critic of a fact which we can't comprehend. How one can lose one's spiritual strength, one's willpower, and possessing freedom not value it, not be willing to make sacrifices for it. That was how Solzhenitsyn saw the West. Spineless. And a bit later on he said this, no doubt Western listeners will find my words embarrassing. Difficult for me to judge this kind of reaction, he said. But I would say this, now ponder on it, ladies and gentlemen, if you take nothing home tonight but this, take this. But I would say this, those people who have lived in the most terrible conditions, on the frontier between life and death, be it people from the West or from the East, they all understand that between good and evil, there is an irreconcilable contradiction that good and evil are not one and the same thing. That one cannot build one's life without regard to this distinction. And I would only say this to you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. You see, I in no way am I concerned in one way what's happened to me tonight. Not at all. But what has happened to me tonight is an object lesson for you to take a message from. If because you stand up to ensure that our children are not exploited, and this is what happens, who is the loser? Not me, my friends. It is the children. And if we are to help them through and create the kind of world in which we care too for these people who are here tonight, of course we should care for them. Of course we should care for them. But if we intend or wish or pray to create between us the kind of world in which our children can grow up unpressurized, unexploited, that is the thing we must remember. Between good and evil, there is an irreconcilable contradiction. Now that is the thing. And every time we are faced with a challenge, let us say to ourselves, with Solzhenitsyn and all he's given to the world, let alone Jesus Christ, what is good and what is evil? What is right and what is wrong? And let us speak up against what is wrong, and let us speak up for what is right. And may God be with us all. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm wet. Would you mind if I went and changed my blouse? Because I've already got a cold, so would you mind if I go and change my blouse?
Ladies and gentlemen, we salute a gallant lady and a fearless crusader. And it's really a very great tribute to Mrs. Whitehouse that her crusade is so effective that it calls forth this sort of juvenile opposition.